deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. I've never had a problem with that being an accurate assessment of the heart of mankind, individually and collectively. In these chapters 17 through 21, the final chapters of this book of Judges, is really an exposé of the heart of man, even the heart of God's people, and what they will become if they choose to do what they believe is right in their own eyes. That's the whole theme of the book. No king in Israel at that time, and every man did that which was right in his own eyes. And then you watch what happens, not just among the ungodly, but among God's people, if they fall prey to that kind of thinking. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. Every person became their own standard. Every person living for self. And here we are firmly entrenching within the youth and within the adults of the United States of America that self is supreme. Live for self. What you think and what you want is most important. It's the preeminent thing. Make that the goal in your life. And as this thing is being spewed forth into hundreds of millions of lives, it seems with the absolute ignorance of what that inevitably produces and has produced throughout the history of mankind, and that is pure anarchy. Once people only care about themselves, and that becomes the supreme thing, then you have anarchy on your hands. You have lawlessness. You have the kind of madness that we see and that we read about and is in our midst in terms of living in this society all around us. And the interesting thing is if the religious community, and I use that as an expression for the body of Christ, those who should know better, the Son of Man didn't, you know, come to save his life, but to give his life as a ransom for many. He didn't come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. And he's our master. He's the one who lives inside of us, designed to live that same life through us. And when we reject that and say, we want nothing to do with that, I want to live for myself. And then when the salt loses its savor, look out. Look out. Because you begin with spiritual anarchy, which is chapter 17 of Judges. And pretty soon it just turns into general anarchy and lawlessness. And that is the survival of the fittest. The strongest get to do whatever they want to do. The most powerful get to do whatever they want to do to the weakest. So we see today now, coming out of these think tanks that have thought themselves so brilliant for the last 40 years and trying to get people to be consumed with themselves, and they realize this is not working, and now what are they trying to develop within us? A community spirit. That we better not think so much about ourselves and help someone out next to us. And now they do a complete turnaround and no one stands up and says, hey, listen, we have been wrong for 40 years. We see the fruit of it all around us. And as bad as that is in the secular realm, it is its greatest tragedy. The body of Christ becomes like that. And the people of God become like that. And that's where Israel is right now. Everyone doing what is right in their own eyes. Is that the standard for your life? Is that the standard for my life? Or is it really the Word of God? Or do I have my own kind of special religion that I've kind of worked out with Him? Kind of a special agreement, you know, He winks at these things over here, and, you know, and then I give Him some extra, you know, things in terms of attention during the week and that kind of thing. It's no good. And yet that's what they're doing. And so the religious system within Israel had fallen down to such a degree that it's just pure superstition. It's the people of God, those who were to be the people of God, no longer living obediently. And so in their disobedience, they thought just as long as they had a golden ephod or a few idols or they had a priest in their house, that it was okay, that would appease God. That would be enough to make him happy. And so really just general religious apostasy here in chapter 17. Now there was a man from the mountains of Ephraim whose name was Micah. And he said to his mother, "The 1,100 shekels of silver that were taken from you and on which you put a curse, even saying it in my ears." Apparently, the 1,100 shekels of silver stolen from her, and she puts a curse, you know, pronounces a curse on whoever it was that stole that 1,100 pieces of silver, and it happened to be her son who heard the curse, and there was a lot of fear and a parental curse in those days, and so he comes and he fesses up and says, "Here is the silver with me, I took it." And his mother said, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my son." And so when he had returned the 1,100 shekels of silver to his mother said, "I had wholly dedicated the silver from my hand to the Lord for my son to make a carved image and a molded image. Now, therefore, I will return it to you." So here is absolute idolatry forbidden by God. They were to not make any images. There was to be none of this. But, you know, she throws the Lord in a little bit here. "Oh, bless the Lord, thank the Lord," you know, that kind of thing. It sanctifies the whole scene. Her son's a thief. And he only confesses because he's afraid of the curse that's on the money now. And so here's all this idolatry, but, you know, just throw some religious jargon in, and surely that appeases God. Surely he's no more holy than that. You know, these little scraps we throw them from our dinner table. Just, you know, the big puppy dog in the sky is satisfied with anything. And thus he returned the silver to his mother, and then his mother took 200 shekels of silver and gave them to the silversmith, and he made it into a carved image and a molded image, and they were in the house of Micah, a violation of the second commandment. And the man Micah had a shrine, and he made an ephod, which was a kind of a symbol of the priestly robe, and household idols, and he consecrated one of his sons who became his priest. So there is all kinds of religious activity going on in Israel and in this family, but no obedience to the Word of God. But isn't it interesting how easy we can become seduced into thinking that a life characterized by disobedience is okay, long as we've, you know, got some religious activity happening, but it's no good. It's no good. And then he makes this priest. He didn't have the ability to make anybody a priest, had no right to do it. But he's got his own little altar there in his house, his own little religious place, his own little, you know, God had just really become kind of a good luck charm for him. You know, he could do this and then go over here and have this life over here, and, you know, this was okay because, you know, God was on board. I got him, you know, right in the other room. I sure had to cast him in silver, but he's right there. And in those days, there was no king in Israel, and here's the theme of Judges. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And again, this is not talking about the pagan nations around Israel. It's talking about Israel, God's people that he had called to be holy unto himself. Now there was a young man from Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah. He was a Levite, and he was sojourning there, temporarily residing. And the man departed from the city of Bethlehem in Judah to sojourn wherever he could find a place. And then he came to the mountains of Ephraim, to the house of Micah, as he journeyed. And Micah said to him, "Where do you come from?" And so he said, "I'm a Levite from Bethlehem in Judah, and I'm on my way to find a place to sojourn." Micah said to him, "Dwell with me and be a father and a priest to me, and I will give you 10 shekels of silver per year, a suit of clothes, and your sustenance." And so the Levite went in. The Levite was content to dwell with the man, and the young man became like one of his sons to him. And so Micah consecrated the Levite, which he had no authority to do. Only the high priest could do that. He consecrates the Levite, and the young man became his priest, and lived in the house of Micah. And then Micah said, now I know that the Lord will be good to me since I have a Levite as priest. You know, got that big stupid God up there. He'll never see through this. He'll just see that priest in there and then I'll get anything I want from him. I mean, a pretty base idea concerning God. That's what he got. All right, now I've got a priest. Had the altar, had the ephod, had the silver images, had everything but a priest. Oh, I made my son a priest, but I really knew that was no good. Now I got myself a surefire Levite. I got me a Levite in the house. Oh, man. Happy days are here again. God's going to bless me for that. The Levites had been called by God to really perform the duties as it related to the handling of the offerings and the handling of the transportation and all of the temple. And they had been called to represent the Lord. They hadn't been called to be bought by some ungodly man to then become a good luck charm for this man. And so this ungodly Micah comes and he makes this offer to this Levite whose responsibility was to represent God. And this Levite takes the offer. He's a hireling. He's a hireling. Not interested in representing God. He's just out for his security. And he settles for some room, some board, place to stay, some food, a little pocket change. That's all he wants. That's what he sells out his priesthood for. Sells it for that. Because he's a man who's just interested in his security. He just wants a little bit of security. That's all he's looking for in the world. That's as big as his picture is. We have to be careful as Christians that we don't sell out for our security. And there's enormous pressure today to do so. Enormous pressure. To say, here is this ungodly person or this ungodly situation, and I will become a part of it, and I will compromise in the midst of it because they keep food on my table, they keep clothes on my back, and they put a little bit of pocket change in my pocket. You see, then I become a hireling when I'm willing to compromise like that. And Jesus knows that there's a great temptation concerning his disciples to seek for security. There was a man that Jesus came to during the course of his public ministry, and he said to the young man, he says, follow me. And the young man said to Jesus, let me first go and bury my father. Doesn't mean that his father had just died and he wanted to attend the funeral. His dad was very much alive. But what he was saying was, I'll follow you as soon as my dad dies, because then when my dad dies, I'll get my portion of the inheritance, and then my security will be taken care of, and then I'll follow you. As soon as my security's taken care of, then I'll enter into what your call is upon my life. And the reason that it never works is you cannot accumulate enough money on the face of this planet to be secure. How many IRAs can you have? How much stock can you have? If you are here tonight and you are a wealthy person, you understand this better than the rest of us. Where do you hide your wealth today? Where is the sure place? This stock market? Foreign stock markets. Everyone thought Japan. I mean, that's as sure as can be until Japan's stock market just plummeted right through the floor. Where are you going to find security today apart from the Lord? It can't be found. Paul Lester would not be in Arkansas if he waited for his security. No one would be serving the Lord in the way that God has called them to serve the Lord if they waited until they got what they esteemed in their mind was sufficient security. It's not there because our security is in the Lord. But he sells out now. He sells out. We must be very careful as Christians not to sell out for some thing that appears to provide security for us. And in those days, chapter 18, there was no king in Israel, and in those days the tribe of the Danites was seeking an inheritance for itself to dwell in. Now, the interesting thing is the Danites had conquered their area of the promised land earlier. They had conquered their area of the promised land and had taken possession of it, but then, instead of walking by faith and living by faith, they were driven out by the enemies. And instead of engaging in a warfare against the enemy, in order to take back their land, they choose to pick a fight with another group of people within the boundaries of Israel, and they just choose the easy way instead of doing what they ought to have done. And so no king, and the tribe of Israel was seeking an inheritance for itself to dwell in, for until that day their whole inheritance among the tribes of Israel had not fallen to them because they hadn't taken it. And what they had taken had been taken from them. And so the children of Dan sent five men of their family from their territory, men of valor from Zorah and Eshtol, to spy out the land and search it. And they said to them, go search the land. And so they went into the mountains of Ephraim to the house of Micah and lodged there. And while they were in the house of Micah, they recognized the voice of the young Levite. So they probably recognized his Judean accent. And they turned to him and said to him, who brought you here? What are you doing in this place? What are you? You know, a priest for hire? What are you doing in this place? What do you have here? And he said, thus and so Micah did for me. Man, I mean, this guy feeds me, puts a roof over my head, and look at this. I got two quarters to rub together. Man, did I hold out for a bundle or what? He has hired me. I mean, he even admits he's a hireling. And I've become his priest. Not God's priest, his priest. And so they said to him, please inquire of God that we may know whether the journey on which we will go will be prosperous. And the priest said to them, go in peace. May the presence of the Lord be with you on your way. And so the five men departed and went to Laish, and they saw the people who were there, how they dwelt safely in the manner of the Sidonians, quiet and secure. There were no rulers in the land who might put them to shame for anything. They were far from the Sidonians, and they had no ties with anyone. So here was this beautiful city, wealthy, rich in terms of the resources around it, but they were isolated, no alliances in terms of military protection. Then the spies came back, verse 8, to their brethren at Zorah and Eshtol, and their brethren said to them, what is your report? And so they said, arise, let us go up against them, for we have seen the land, and indeed it's very good. Would you do nothing? Do not hesitate to go, that you may enter to possess the land. And when you go, you will come to a secure people in a large land, for God has given it into your hands, a place where there is no lack of anything that is on the earth. God hadn't given it to him at all. But you know, you say these things flippantly when you're not walking with them. And the 600 men of the family of the Danites went from there, from Zorah and Eshtol, armed with weapons of war, and they went up and encamped in Kirjath-Jearim in Judah. And therefore, say that three times, Chris, I'll tell you. And they call that place Mahanah Dan to this day. There it is, west of Kirjath-Jearim. And they passed from there to the mountains of Ephraim and came to the house of Micah, this large group, 600 men of war. And then the five men who had gone out to spy the country of Laish answered and said to their brethren, do you know that there are in these houses an ephod, household idols, a carved image, and a molded image? Now, therefore, consider what you should do. In other words, go take them for yourself. So they turned aside there and came to the house of the young Levite man, that is, to the house of Micah, and greeted him. The 600 men, armed with their weapons of war, who were of the children of Dan, stood by the entrance of the gate. Then the five men who had gone up out of the land went up to spy out the land, went up, and entering there, they took the carved image, the ephod, the household idols, and the molded image. Now listen, if someone can steal it, it's not worth worshiping. It just isn't. If someone can steal it, then you just know automatically, listen, if that God can't protect itself, It can't protect me. What am I doing wasting my time? And so here they are. These images are stolen. And so, you know, don't even waste your time with a relationship with God that can be stolen or that kind of a thing. And so the priest stood at the entrance of the gate with the 600 men who were armed with weapons of war. And when these went into Micah's house and took the graven image, the ephod, and the household idols and the molded image, the young priest said to them, "What are you doing?" And they said to him, "Be quiet, put your hand over your mouth and come with us." And don't say anything. Be a father and a priest to us. Is it better for you to be a priest to the household of one man, or that you be a priest to a tribe and a family in Israel? Now listen. If you hire a hireling, you got to know that he's going to go when the next best offer comes. That's the problem of dealing with hirelings. And so now they come with a better offer, and they're, you know, tweaking his selfish ambition. And I mean, this guy's motivated by all of the wrong things as it relates to service. So listen, this is a little more powerful, a little higher position, you know, so come and be a part of this. And so the priest's heart, he's glad. He took the ephod and the household idols and the carved image and took his place among the people. All right, this is my lucky day. And then they turned and departed and put the little ones, the livestock, and the goods in front of them. And when they were a good way from the house of Micah, the men who were in the houses near Micah's house gathered together and overtook the children of Dan. Now these are all Israelites. These are brethren. It's happening among brethren. They called out to the children of Dan. So they turned around and said to Micah, "What ails you that you've gathered such a company?" So he said, "You've taken away my gods which I made." You made a god? Was it a Lego kid or what? I mean, you know, a light ought to go on somewhere in there. "You've taken away my gods which I made, and the priest, and you've gone away. Now what more do I have?" Well, how about a real relationship with God? "How can you say to me, 'What ails you?'" And the children of Dan said to him, "Do not let your voice be heard among us. Be quiet, lest angry men," there's a few of us, "fall upon you and you lose your life with the lives of your household." You see, now once everyone is doing what is right in their own eyes, again, might makes right. And that's what's going on here, and that's what we see so much of, not only around us today, but internationally, really. "And then the children of Dan went their way, and when Micah saw that they were too strong for him, he turned and went back to his house," left empty. "And so they took the things Micah had made and the priest who had belonged to him and went to Laish, to a people who were quiet and secure, and they struck them with the edge of the sword and burned the city with fire. There was no deliverer because it was far from Sidon, and they had no ties with anyone. It was in the valley that belongs to Beth-Rehob, and so they rebuilt the city and dwelt there. And they called the name of the city Dan, after the name of Dan their father, who was born to Israel. However, the name of the city formerly was Laish. And then the children of Israel set up for themselves the carved image, and Jonathan the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh, and his sons were priests to the tribe of Dan until the day of the captivity of the land. And so they set up for themselves Micah's carved image, which he made all the time that the house of God was in Shiloh." So just the horrible, horrible condition of God's people here. That they could just go in and slay, cold-blooded murder, an entire village. And not only do it, but think that they were in relationship with God in doing it. Still set up the ephod, still set up the priest, still set up the whole thing. They just didn't even connect the two. So far along in their apostasy they were. Doesn't matter, whatever I do, as long as I've got a little religious activity going on, that makes everything holy. And that's
sense of thinking. And it came to pass, chapter 19, in those days, when there was no king in Israel, that there was a certain Levite sojourning in the remote mountains of Ephraim. I don't think I'd hang out there, but he did. Sounds like the whole nation's pretty wild. And he took for himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. No priest, no Levite, was ever to have a concubine. A concubine was a wife of a second degree. And so there were to be no concubines for a Levite. But everyone's doing what's right in their own eyes. So he gets a concubine. But his concubine played the harlot against him. She was sexually unfaithful and went away from him to her father's house at Bethlehem in Judah and was there 4 whole months. And then her husband arose and went after her to speak kindly to her and bring her back, having his servant and a couple of donkeys with him. And so she brought him into her father's house. And when the father of the young woman saw him, he was glad to meet him. Now his father-in-law, the young woman's father, detained him, and he stayed with him 3 days. So they ate and drank and lodged there. And then it came to pass on the 4th day that they arose early in the morning, and he stood to depart. But the young woman's father said to his son-in-law, "Refresh your heart with a morsel of bread, and afterward go your way." And so they sat down, and the two of them ate and drank together. And then the young woman's father said to the man, "Please be content to stay all night and let your heart be merry." And when the man stood to depart, his father-in-law urged him, and so he lodged there again another night. Then he arose early in the morning on the 5th day to depart, but the young woman's father said, "Please refresh your heart." And so they delayed until afternoon, and they both of them ate. And when the man stood to depart, he and his concubine and his servant, his father-in-law, the young woman's father, said to him, "Look, the day is now drawing towards evening. Please spend the night. See, the day is coming to an end. Lodge here that your heart may be merry. Tomorrow you go your way early that you may get home." You can get home all the way just in one trip. But the man was not willing to spend that night, and so he arose and departed and came to a place opposite Jebus, that is Jerusalem. And with him were the 2 saddled donkeys. His concubine was also with him. And they were near Jebus, and the day was far spent, and the servant said to his master, "Come, please, let us turn aside into this city of the Jebusites and lodge in it." Now, at that time, Jerusalem is under the control of the Jebusites, controlled by what the Jews would look at and say, the ungodly. And so the master said to him, the Levite, "We will not turn aside here into a city of foreigners who are not of the children of Israel. We will go on to Gibeah," because Gibeah belonged to the tribe of Benjamin. So here's this Levite. He's an Israelite. And he's just got, it's the end of the day. And in those days, it's not safe to travel by night. There are no police forces, none of that kind of thing. You get caught out on a road in the middle of the night, you're in big trouble, especially in this kind of a day. And so he says, "No, let's not go in among the ungodly. There's no telling what kind of treatment we might get there among the Jebusites. Let's go on, even though it takes us about 4 more miles, let's go on to Gibeah and we'll stay there where, you know, God's people, Israelites, control the city." And in his mind, he has the idea that his people, the Israelites, God's people, will be more hospitable than the ungodly. And he is in for a rude awakening. When a child of God turns from the Lord, how often he becomes so unrecognizable that you are safer being with the ungodly than being with him. It's wild. It's wild. The spiritual warfare. And so this is his reasoning. They said, "No, we won't do it." And so he said to his servant, verse 13, "Come, let us draw near to one of these places and spend the night in Gibeah or Ramah." And they passed by and went their way, and the sun went down on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin, one of the tribes of Israel. And they turned aside to go in to lodge in Gibeah. And when they went in, they sat down in the open square of the city, for no one would take them into his house to spend the night. Highly unusual among the tribes, when they were very much given to hospitality. And when a Jew would be traveling through and sit down in the open courtyard, somebody would come along and invite them. It was an honor to extend hospitality to God's people. But nobody was doing it to them. And just then, an old man came in from his work in the field at evening. There he's working all day long, working into the evening. He's an old man. He has the character of an old man. And he comes in, who was also from the mountains of Ephraim, and he was sojourning in Gibeah, whereas the men of the place were Benjamites. And then he raised his eyes, and he saw the traveler in the open square of the city, and the old man said, where are you going, and where do you come from? The Levite said to him, we're passing from Bethlehem in Judah towards the remote mountains of Ephraim. And I am from there. I went to Bethlehem in Judah, and now I'm going to the house of the Lord. But there is no one who will take me into his house. Although we have both straw and fodder for our donkeys and bread and wine for myself, we're not asking any resources of them. For your maidservant and the young man who is with your servant, there is no lack of anything. And the old man said to him, peace be with you. However, let all your needs be my responsibility. Only do not spend the night in the open square. Don't spend the night out here. Bad things can happen. Well, wait a second. This is a godly city. I mean, what are you talking about? He says, no, I'll supply all of what you need. You just come and spend the night with me. Now, you and I, there are not too many of us who would just go out into some area of Modesto and then just lie down on the street and go to sleep there. Why wouldn't you do it? It's not terribly safe, is it? It is interesting that we could ask ourselves, why isn't it safe? Well, it's not safe because man is every day and in every way getting better and better. No, it's not safe because man is wicked to the core. Bad things can happen to you out there, that kind of a situation. And so the old man calls him in, and he brought him into his house and gave fodder to the donkeys, and they washed their feet and they ate and they drank. You know, they've been traveling here, and now this refreshment and hospitality is just terrific. And here we are, we're living in this city that's controlled by the men of Benjamin. We're safe, we're among brothers. Oh, this is terrific. Aren't you glad we didn't stay in Jebus where those mere pagans were running the holiday? And I mean, here we are, right? We're safe among God's people. While they were enjoying themselves, suddenly certain men of the city perverted them. Surrounded the house, and they beat on the door, and they spoke to the master of the house, the old man, saying, bring out the man who came to your house, that we may know him carnally. They wanted to, just the whole city, to homosexually rape him here on this scene. They're going to, just they want to kill him, you know, and just sexually abuse him. This is among God's people. When everyone does what's right in their own eyes, it's amazing what the flesh will justify. But the man, the master of the house, he went out to them and he said to them, no, my brethren, I beg you, do not act so wickedly, seeing the man has come into my house. Do not commit this outrage. Now, when in that Middle Eastern culture to this day, if I am invited into a Jew's house or a Muslim's house, and they have invited me in as a Christian, and if I, even in that environment, were to speak things that would cause the Muslim to be hostile towards me, he doesn't agree with what I'm saying or my God and who it is that I stand for, these things, he would treat me with hospitality and feed me the very best from his house, take care of me to the best of his ability. So strong
is the tie to hospitality there. And so you never threw someone out that you invited to your house. It was an affront, and they don't to this day. And so they're wanting to pull him out, and he says, this is an outrage. And then in verse 24, he says, look, here is my virgin daughter and the man's concubine. Let me bring them out now and humble them and do with them as you please. But to this man, do not do such a vile thing. Now remember, God is giving us an account. He is recording the condition of these people. He is not condoning this. They're a million miles from what he had intended his people to be. How far the Levite had fallen, how far this man from Ephraim had fallen, how far the men of Benjamin. It's all just horrible, horrible, horrible. Everyone on the scene, just absolutely terrible. But the men would not heed him. And so the man, the Levite, took his concubine in order to save his own neck and threw her out to them. And they knew her, and they abused her all night until morning. And when the day began to break, they let her go. Then the woman came as the day was dawning and fell down at the door of the man's house where her master was till it was light. And when her master arose, he slept through the night, in the morning, and opened the doors of the house and went out to go on his way. There was his concubine, fallen at the door of the house with her hands on the threshold, trying to drag herself into the house. And he said to her, get up, let's be going. But there was no answer, and so the man lifted her onto the donkey, and the man got up and went to his place. Such vileness. Such terrible wickedness. And when we would be tempted today to say, no, but we've become much more civilized today. Have we really? Just a few years ago, just a couple of years ago, don't forget the rape camps in Europe. In Europe. Not some, you know, uncivilized section of the other world that the world calls, you know, third world or developing or whatever. In Europe, in Yugoslavia, rape camps. War is the same way. They defeat the men and rape the women. It goes on to this day. In Rwanda, just a year ago, 9 months ago, now you read the article in the paper where they have now thousands of babies being born. And every woman in that battle that occurred over the control of Rwanda, all of the women, the wives and the daughters of the men who lost that battle, every single one who lived was raped. Just the horror of it. Say, Lord, come quickly. Lord, come quickly. Stop this nonsense. And you'll never convince me that man is getting better. And so he entered into his house when he got home, and he took a knife and he laid hold of his concubine. And he dismembered her into 12 pieces, limb by limb, you know, literally bone by bone, and sent her throughout all the territory of Israel. Now the interesting thing here is that he sends a section of her body back to the Benjamites. They're one of the 12. But he sends out now 12 pieces of this woman's body out in all directions now to the different men in tribes in Israel. And so it was that all who saw it said, no such deed has been done or seen from the day that the children of Israel came up from the land of Egypt until this day. Consider it. This is good counsel concerning evil. God's people, in the midst of evil. Consider it. Take counsel and speak up. And so he sends out these portions of the body. Did God direct him to do that? No, he didn't direct him to do that.
Again, it's a record of what happened. And he cuts up this body and he sends it in all directions in order that when a woman's leg shows up, the men of that tribe would be repulsed by it, shocked by it, and just shocked back into reality. Look at where we've fallen. Look at how far we've gone. And it'd be just a wake-up call to how far down the path. You wonder if we can be shocked anymore. You know, I have to be careful because, you know, I can watch the historical account of Jeffrey Dahmer and eat a bowl of cereal. And every time I pick up the news, it's some mass desecration, some slaughter, some horrible. The killing is bad enough, but now it's just, you know, the mangling and the horror of it. I wonder what could shock us. I mean, really, what could shock us to rise up in this day? I just thank the Lord for the work of His Spirit that keeps us shockable in this day and in this hour. We need to be shockable. And then all of the children of Israel came out, verse chapter 20, from Dan to Beersheba, as well as from the land of Gilead. And the congregation gathered together as one man before the Lord at Mizpah. And so here they are, the nation, the whole nation now is going to address the wickedness in their midst. They woke up. This is wrong. This is out of control. And the leaders of all the people, all the tribes of Israel, presented themselves in the assembly of the people of God, 400,000 foot soldiers who drew the sword. Now the children of Benjamin heard that the children of Israel had gone up to Mizpah. And then the children of Israel said, "Tell us, how did this wicked deed happen?" So they want to gather the facts about what's happening first. And the Levite, the husband of the woman, this is a rather sanctified version, I might say, of the account. "My concubine and I went into Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin, to spend the night. The men of Gibeah rose against me and surrounded the house at night because of me. They intended to kill me, but instead they ravished my concubine so that she died." Now, he kind of leaves his part out, doesn't he? "And so I took hold of my concubine, cut her in pieces, and sent her throughout all the territory of the inheritance of Israel because they committed lewdness and outrage in Israel." Well, I think he was outrageous in putting her out the door, but we will get into that. "Look, you are all of you are children of Israel. Give your advice and counsel here and now." In this they are correct. This has happened in our midst, and now we're responsible for it. One of our tribes, one of our people have done this. And like it or not, it becomes a reflection on the rest of us. And because of that, we must deal with it. Just like church discipline today, the body of Christ. "Then all of the people arose as one man, saying, 'None of us will go back to his tent, nor will any of us turn back to his house. But now this is the thing which we will do to Gibeah. We will go up against it by lot. And we will take 10 men out of every 100 throughout all the tribes of Israel, 100 out of every 1,000, and 1,000 out of every 10,000 to make provisions for the people that when they come to Gibeah in Benjamin, they may repay all the vileness that they have done in Israel." And so that recognition that now that Benjamin has drawn them into their sin, they have a responsibility now to deal with it. "And so all of the men of Israel were gathered together against the city, united together as one man against that sin." Terrific. "And then the tribes of Israel sent men through all the tribe of Benjamin, saying, 'What is this wickedness that has occurred among you? Now therefore deliver up the men, the perverted men who are in Gibeah. We don't want to take on your entire tribe. We just want the people from that city who did this.' and we want you to turn them over to us for justice, that we may put them to death and remove the evil from Israel. Benjamin has an opportunity to do what's right, and that is to deliver these men, but they refuse to do it. They would not listen to the voice of their brethren and the children of Israel. And instead, the children of Benjamin gathered together from their cities to Gibeah to go to battle against the children of Israel. And from their cities at that time, the children of Benjamin numbered 26,000 men who drew the sword, beside the inhabitants of Gibeah, who numbered 700 select men. Among all this people, there were 700 select men who were left-handed. Everyone could sling a stone at a hair's breadth and not miss. In other words, they were ambidextrous. When it says they were left-handed, it means they were trained in warfare with both their right hand and their left hand. Tremendous advantage in warfare in that day. Now, Benjamin, instead of delivering these men up, which was the right thing to do, they're going to defend these men. And because they align themselves in the defense of these men, they're going to be drawn into a battle that they cannot win. And when we find ourselves being drawn into the defense of something that is wrong and we ought to have no part of, it can draw us into battles that God does never intend. And you can't win because their fight is against the Lord, and the Lord is going to win. Now, besides Benjamin, verse 17, the men of Israel numbered 400,000 men who drew the sword. All of these were men of war. And the children of Israel arose, and they went up to the house of God to seek counsel of God. And they said, "Which of us shall go up first to battle against the children of Benjamin?" And the Lord said, "Judah shall go up first." And so the children of Israel rose in the morning and encamped against Gibeah. And the men of Israel went out to battle against Benjamin, and the men of Israel put themselves in battle array to fight against them at Gibeah. And then the children of Benjamin came out of Gibeah, and on that day cut down to the ground 22,000 men of the Israelites. Ooh, that didn't go quite like they had planned. And the people, that is the men of Israel, encouraged themselves and again formed the battle line at the place where they had put themselves in array on the first day. And then the children of Israel went up and they wept before the Lord until evening and asked counsel of the Lord, saying, "Shall I again draw near for battle against the children of my brother Benjamin?" And the Lord said, "Go up against him." And so the children of Israel approached the children of Benjamin on the second day, and Benjamin went out against them from Gibeah on the second day and cut down to the ground 18,000 more of the children of Israel, all those who drew the sword. Wow, that's 0 for 2. And about 40,000 dead, one-tenth of your army, dead in 2 days. And what are you going to do? You're fighting for what's right. You're fighting under the direction of God. And yet it looks like you're going to take a pounding. Looks like you're going to lose this battle. Sometimes when we think of spiritual warfare, we have a very sanctified view of it, don't we? It's all done with high-tech weaponry. We just launch missiles, you know, the intercontinental missiles and stuff like that. But it's interesting, the description of spiritual warfare in Ephesians chapter 6, the very language indicates hand-to-hand combat. It can get very messy. And it can get very desperate. And it can get very tiring. And I don't know the whys of this passage. I don't know the whys of the two defeats. God keeps that to himself, and I'm glad to leave that with himself. But the men of Benjamin had gotten strong in their wickedness, not overnight. And we look and we say, well, you know, it's just really one concubine and the wickedness in one city. And yet, perhaps there is in all of this, those other 11 tribes, they ought to have addressed the wickedness in their own life and the wickedness of this tribe long before they gained that kind of a strength. Because you don't think that the Benjamites are just going to fall down and let themselves be killed in battle. They're going to give a fierce fight. They're going to lose, but they're going to fight fiercely. And we look at some of the battles that we go through as Christians. The attempt to try and regain some ground that maybe we lost while we were asleep. And we think that it'll just happen, you know, in one little flick of the wrist, one little deal like this, and then all of a sudden we realize it's real warfare. And Satan doesn't give up ground he's gained easily. There's a lot involved in it. And he's going to lose, but it's going to get messy before he does lose. The Benjamites and also Satan himself, demonic forces. And so, it's a pretty heavy scene here. All I know is that I would not want to have been the priest who was seeking of God whether they should have gone into battle or not. Don't you think that his job security was like about on a par with an NFL coach? I mean, that's 0-2, and there have been big problems. The children of Israel, that is all the people, verse 26, went up and they came to the house of the Lord of God and wept. And they sat there before the Lord and fasted that day until evening. And they offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. And so the children of Israel inquired of the Lord. The Ark of the Covenant of God was there in those days. And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, stood before it in those days saying, shall I yet again go out to battle against the children of my brother Benjamin, or shall I cease? And the Lord said, go up, for tomorrow I will deliver them into your hand. And then Israel set men in ambush all around Gibeah, and the children of Israel went up against the children of Benjamin on the third day, and they put themselves in battle array against Gibeah as on the other times. And so the children of Benjamin went out against the people and were drawn away from the city. They began to strike down and kill some of the children of Israel, as at other times in the highways and in the field, about 30 men of Israel. And the children of Benjamin said, they are struck down before us as at first. But the children of Israel said, let us flee and draw them out from the city to the highways. And so all the men of Israel rose from their place and put themselves in battle array at Baal Tamar. And then Israel's men in ambush burst forth from their position in the plain of Geba, and 10,000 select men from all Israel came against Gibeah, and the battle was fierce. But the Benjamites did not know that disaster was upon them. And the Lord defeated Benjamin before Israel, and the children of Israel destroyed that day 25,100 Benjamites. All these drew the sword. Victory came with faith and perseverance. The promises that God has given us will always end in victory, and we must never cease to persevere until we see that victory, because it's forthcoming. It's already ours. It's a matter of time before it's revealed. And so the children of Benjamin saw that they were defeated, and the men of Israel had given ground to the Benjamites because they relied on the men in ambush whom they had set against Gibeah. And the men in ambush quickly rushed against Gibeah. The men in ambush spread out and struck the whole city with the edge of the sword. Now the appointed signal between the men of Israel and the men in ambush was that they would make a great cloud of smoke rise up from the city, whereupon the men of Israel would turn in battle. Now Benjamin had begun to strike and kill about 30 of the men of Israel, for they said, surely they are defeated before us as in the first battle, but when the cloud began to rise from the city in a column of smoke, the Benjamites turned and looked behind them, and there was the whole city going up in smoke to heaven. They'd been ambushed, and they knew it. And the men of Israel turned back, and the men of Benjamin panicked, for they saw that disaster had come upon them. Therefore, they turned their backs before the men of Israel in the direction of the wilderness. But the battle overtook them, and whoever had come out of the cities, they destroyed in their midst. They surrounded the Benjamites and chased them and easily trampled them down as far as the front of Gibeah toward the east. And 18,000 men of Benjamin fell. All these were men of valor. And then they turned and fled toward the wilderness to the rock of Rimmon. And they cut down 5,000 of them on the highways. And then they pursued them relentlessly up to Gittim and killed 2,000 of them. And so all who fell of Benjamin that day were 25,000 who drew the sword. All of these were men of valor. But 600 men turned and fled toward the wilderness of the rock of Rimmon, and they stayed at that place for 4 months. And the men of Israel turned back from the children of Benjamin and struck them down with the edge of the sword. From every city, men and beasts, all who were found, and they also set fire to all the cities they came to. Now the men of Israel had sworn an oath at Mizpah, saying, "None of us shall give his daughter to Benjamin as wife." And so they make a vow. They're mad at Benjamin, they're upset, they see their vileness, and they say, "That does it, no matter what happens, we're not going to give any of our daughters to these men as wives." And the problem is that they killed every woman of the tribe of Benjamin. So you have an entire tribe that is almost wiped out. Only 600 men survive. And no women to marry. And they can't receive the wives, or the daughters rather, of the men of any of the other tribes. And then the people came, verse to the house of the Lord, and remained there before God until evening. And they lifted up their voices and they wept bitterly and said, "O Lord God of Israel, why has this come to pass in Israel that today there should be one tribe missing in Israel? Lord, they're almost wiped out. One of the 12 gone." And so it was on the next morning that the people rose early and they built an altar there and they offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. And the children of Israel said, "Who is there among all the tribes of Israel who did not come up with the assembly to the Lord?" For they had made a great oath concerning anyone who had not come up to the Lord at Mizpah, saying, "He shall surely be put to death." And the children of Israel grieved for Benjamin, their brother, and said, "One tribe is cut off from Israel today. What shall we do for wives for those who remain, seeing we have sworn by the Lord that we will not give them our daughters as wives?" They've made a stupid vow, and now they got to deal with it. And they said, "What one is there from the tribes of Israel who did not come up to Mizpah to the Lord?" And in fact, no one had come up to the camp from Jabesh-Gilead to the assembly. And so here is Jabesh-Gilead. They said, "Listen, we don't want to get into that fight, into that battle. I don't care how wicked it is." And they didn't enter into the battle. And so, in a sense, condoning the wickedness. But it does not give any excuse for what's about to happen here. "For when the people were counted, indeed, not one of the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead was there. And so the congregation sent out there 12,000 of their most valiant men and commanded them, saying, 'Go and strike the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead with the edge of the sword, including women and children.'" Now again, this is all going on among God's people. Ever been through a church split? "And this," verse 11, "is the thing that you shall do. You shall utterly destroy every male and every woman who has known a man intimately." And so they found among the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead 400 young virgins who had not known a man intimately, and they brought them to the camp at Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan. Again, this is God just giving the account that he is in no way a part of this whole trip that's going on. And then the whole congregation sent word to the children of Benjamin who were at the Rock of Rimmon and announced peace to them. And so Benjamin came back at that time, and they gave them the 400 women that they had stolen from this other city, whom they had saved alive of the women of Jabesh-Gilead, and yet they had not found enough for them. So there's 200 guys, you know, without a wife in order for this repopulation of the tribe. And the people grieved for Benjamin because the Lord had made a void in the tribes of Israel. And then the elders of the congregation said, "What shall we do for wives for those who remain, since the women of Benjamin have been destroyed?" And they said, "There must be an inheritance for the survivors of Benjamin, that a tribe may not be destroyed from Israel. However, we cannot give them wives from our daughters, for the children of Israel have sworn an oath, saying, 'Cursed be the one who gives a wife to Benjamin.'" Then they said, "Aha, how do we get away? I mean, we said we wouldn't give one. We said we wouldn't give our daughters. See, we said we wouldn't give. We said we wouldn't give. Is there a lawyer around? How can we get around? We said we wouldn't give. There's got to be a clause here." And so then they said, "In fact, there is a yearly feast of the Lord in Shiloh, which is north of Bethel on the east side of the highway that goes up from Bethel to Shechem and south of this place. And therefore, they instructed the children of Benjamin, saying, 'When this feast occurs, go, lie in wait in the vineyards and watch. And just when the daughters of Shiloh come out to perform their dances and then come out of the vineyards, you know, choose the one you want, and every man catch a wife for himself from the daughters of Shiloh and then go to the land of Benjamin.'" Sorry that the men of Benjamin weren't power brokers and, you know, I mean, is all of the plunder of war is being divided. And so, you know, they're sacrificed here. This is very common in history. "And then it shall be when their fathers or their brothers come to complain to us." Hey, wait a second. They stole 200 of our daughters here. And we said that we wouldn't give our daughters as wives to these men. Oh, wait, did you say give? You didn't give them. They took them. So it's A-okay. All right. There's some logic for you. "And then it shall be when the fathers come to complain, the brothers come, that we'll say to them, 'Be kind to them for our sakes, because we did not take a wife for any of them in the war, for it is not as though you have given the young women to them at this time.'" I mean, you didn't give them, making yourselves guilty of the oath. And so the children of Benjamin did so. They took themselves enough wives for their number, from those who danced, they wanted good dancers, and whom they caught. And then they went and returned to their inheritance, and they built the cities and dwelt in them. And so the children of Israel departed from there at that time, every man to his tribe and family. They went out from there, every man to his inheritance. And then the postscript over this whole terrible era of the history of God's people and the nation of Israel. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. Lord, come quickly. Come quickly. This whole thing is just indefensible for what it is that's going on, but it's a picture of what even God's people will do when they leave fellowship with Him. I've gone a couple minutes over, but let me finish with this point just for a moment. Those of you who have been coming on the Sunday nights from Genesis 1:1, you are able to understand the fullness of the tragedy of this scene because you have learned what God was willing to do for these people and what He had promised them if they had only obeyed. Look what they gave up and look what they ended up with for their rebellion against God. what he wanted to do, what he was willing to do, if they had just simply obeyed him. And it's the case with all of our lives here tonight.